maybe a little bit more upfront, because that's the hope, is this is going to be more of a discussion. Anyway, the this last panel's on basically on immigration and on trying to find discuss rather than just the basic immigration question the way it's often discussed. Trying to discuss it in terms of the effect of immigration on a whole number of different factors, and I think you're going to go over the specific factors, aren't you, Tamar?
Yes.
And what we've asked Tamar Jacoby and Matt Spaulding to do is both give quite brief presentations talking about a few of the factors that we should look at in terms of figuring out how we're doing immigration. And so without further ado, I'm going to very briefly introduce both of them. Tamar Jacoby is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and has, among other things, been doing some of the best work around on immigration for a while. Matt Spaulding is, I've already forgotten, the Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And Matt, in addition to that, has also edited a book, which if any of you are not aware of, you should, was one of the three editors of a book, which if you're not aware of, you should be, which was The Heritage Guide to the Constitution, which was absolutely superb, basically work on the Constitution, analyzing each of the clauses, and it's drawing, I don't know how many authors you had.
108.
108 authors. They had really good people, and it's an extraordinary work. We've tried to help with getting it around and getting it known to yourself. And if you aren't aware of it, you should be. So with that, what I'm going to do is have both of them make brief presentations, and then I really do view this as being a discussion. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tamar.
Thank you, Gene. I think I can. Can you hear me? Should I talk into the mic, or can you hear me without the mic?
I probably talk into the mic. It's because we're trying to record.
Oh, okay.
We're not sure we're going to use it. We're trying to record.
Okay.
Although I think in the discussion it may fall apart a little bit as we.
So we've been asked to do the impossible, which is talk about the effects of immigration on economics, demography, crime, security, and culture in 5 minutes. Each of those could be several-hour presentation. And before I even get to talking about those effects, I think talking about the effects of something like immigration is a little bit like saying a Martian comes to the U.S. and says, you know, what are babies all about? And you say, well, let me talk to you about the effects of having a baby. And you say, well, you know, buy more diapers, more frequent laundry, higher decibel level in the house. If you only talk about the effects, you're not kind of getting at the phenomenon. So I have to take at least one of my 5 minutes to talk a little bit about the phenomenon, and then I'll get to the effects. Because it's an easy misunderstanding to think that immigration is some kind of an experiment that we're doing, that we just turned on a faucet in 1965, that, you know, Senator Kennedy passed a bill that turned on the faucet. That's a voluntary experiment, and now we're looking at the effects that we could somehow change if we turned off the faucet. But that is not the case, and that's a fundamental misunderstanding, I think, out there in the debate. The immigration flows that we're seeing today, which are at historic highs, are driven by fundamental economic and demographic shifts in this country and abroad, but in this country particularly, that make the flows we're seeing all but inevitable. So when you talk about managing it, it's not about turning it off or turning it on, letting those effects convince you to turn it off. It's about a given that we have to try to manage as intelligently as we can. And what I'm talking about when I talk about those economic and demographic fundamentals are aging and shrinking population. The native-born population is approaching, in the next several decades, approaching replacement level, replacement fertility. 75 million baby boomers are going to retire in the next five to seven years. The fact I always say there's one set of numbers you have to know to understand the immigrant flow. In 1960, half of all American men dropped out of high school and wanted to do unskilled work. Half, 1960, when many of us were already around. Now less than 10% drop out of high school and want to do unskilled work. So we are seeing a fundamental shift of tectonic plates in this country economically and demographically. We still need people to do that kind of work. That's what's driving the immigrant flow. So, you know, that's the baby. And basically, it's good for the economy. They are not stealing jobs so much as they're doing jobs that Americans don't want to do and permitting, making possible economic growth. In the last decade, immigrants took half of all the new jobs. And they didn't take them from Americans. They took jobs that there weren't other people to fill. They made possible half of the economic growth we saw in the past decade. And the jobs that the job that an immigrant takes in a meatpacking plant is a job that an American wouldn't do. That allows the meatpacking plant to stay in America. That allows cattle raising and hog raising to stay in America. That allows a lot of middle managers at meatpacking and in farms and in all the businesses up and downstream from farms and meatpacking, everything from the truckers that, you know, take the food from the farm to the meatpacking to the people that write the insurance for those trucks to the people that sell the gas to those trucks. That allows all those other kinds of people to keep their job in the economy to grow. So it's immigrants are not stealing jobs. Immigrants are helping grow the economy up and downstream from where they actually take the jobs. And, you know, people worry about the fiscal consequences. They say, well, are they taking out more services than they're paying in taxes? That's about a wash. It's not a total wash. There's more costs at the local level and more benefits at the federal level. Social Security runs a $7 billion excess every year that's from illegal immigrants paying in Social Security taxes that they don't take out. So at the federal level, we're actually benefiting fiscally. At the local level, there are costs. But you can see what if people that have tried to compare those fiscal costs to the real economic growth made possible, you see how much disparity is. A state like North Carolina, where they've done the best study, over the past decade, if you take the taxes paid in and you subtract the service value of the services taken out by immigrants, it was a $61 million cost over 10 years. Now, that's not nothing, $61 million. But the economic growth made possible in North Carolina in those years was $11 billion. So, like, not even comparable. So that service tax calculation comes out at the state level, it can be real money. But you add in the economic growth made possible, and that's a cost to be managed. That has to be managed differently. And the problem is the taxes are being paid in at the feds and not at the local level. But economically, there's no question that immigrants are benefiting the country, making economic growth possible. And for most Americans, for all but the 10% or the 9% that don't graduate from high school, actually raising wages because they're making people more productive. You know, if you were and the best example is the kitchen staff. If you were a sous chef in a restaurant where suddenly you can open a second restaurant in town because there are enough immigrants there to be the busboys and the wait staff, suddenly you're the chef. And then there's in every economy there have to be Indians and chiefs, so to speak. And more Indians make possible more jobs for chiefs and make it possible for most Americans or many Americans at the middle level to rise up to more productive jobs because there are these people willing to do the less skilled jobs. So economically, there's no question it's a big boon and a boon that the fiscal costs that most people talk about don't even get close to. I've already used up my 5 minutes just on economics. So let's go demographically. You know, I would argue, as you can see, without immigration, we would be coming close to soon being a shrinking country, as the countries of Europe are shrinking countries. I don't believe that's good for a country. I mean, there are people out there who think, you know, we've got enough people and let's stop. I don't think Europe thinks that anymore. Without people, it's hard to grow businesses. It's hard to have soldiers. It's hard to have enough consumers. Your country gets older and older, less innovation, less vitality. We have right now, when you look at the statistics, the way they measure, it's Europeans do the measuring, so it's per kilometer. We have per habitable kilometer 48 people. Japan has 1,606 people per habitable kilometer. Germany has 341 people per habitable kilometer. So we are no way yet getting to be an overcrowded country. I mean, Japan's a pretty crowded country, but the UK and Germany are not yet crowded, unpleasant countries. We have a lot of way to go. And if our population was shrinking, I think it would be bad for the country. Economically, demographically, crime, it's also practically not an issue. There is the drug trade, so you do see drug trade immigrants in the correctional system because of the drug trade. But when you compare the statistics of crime for 18 to 39 year old men incarcerated, U.S. born 3.5%, foreign-born Mexicans under 1%. They commit less crime than the native-born, and certainly less crime than the native-born of their socioeconomic level, leaving aside the fact that they're here illegally, of course. I mean, we're not talking about people in prison for being here illegally, but other crime, less crime. The problem, and what my side's argument is in the debate about reform, is that what we have now is an economic need that's about the laws of supply and demand are generating a flow of about 1.5 million immigrants a year coming here to work. And they come here to work. They don't get welfare. If you're going to be unemployed, it's cheaper and warmer and easier to be unemployed at home. They come here to work. Our visa system only allows in 1 million. So we have a 1.5 million flow and a million visas. And so you have, by nature, my argument is as if we were making cars here and we needed to import the steel, but we had quotas that meant that a third of the steel was by nature bootleg. You know, the government fighting the laws of supply and demand. Quotas a third below what we need to meet the supply and demand. Our side's answer is we're not talking about increasing immigration. Comprehensive immigration reform isn't about increasing the numbers. It's about saying let's allow that flow that's now coming illegally to come legally. And that would eliminate a lot of the problems that are now associated with immigration. We could plan better about those fiscal costs. We could think better about how to organize the emergency rooms and the schools. We wouldn't have the people who are benefiting now are the smugglers and the unscrupulous employers. Let's set it up so that the employers who want to play fair are benefiting, so that these people don't have to live outside the law. And the security dividend would be huge. Not only would we stop having the erosion of the rule of law that we have, but, once these people are coming legally, instead of coming in a bootleg situation, it's a much better situation for security. I mean, I'll never forget the border guard who said to me, and this was after 9/11, it was in Arizona, he said, if another 9/11 happens, and it happens on my watch, because I'm chasing your next busboy or my next gardener, I'll never forgive myself. So, let's let the busboys and the gardeners to figure out a way for them to come through a legal program that meets that, where the laws or the quotas are more commensurate with the laws of supply and demand, and then the border guards can be chasing the bad guys. And I think once you do that, so security, I think at the moment, yes, immigrants do pose a security threat because they create a kind of sea for bad guys to swim in and a bad guy industry, forgery, smugglers, whatever, and implicitly terrorists. Take these people out of the illegal column, give them a legal way to come to the country, I think you would reduce the security concerns. And I'm way over my 5 minutes now. The last one is culture. I believe in the same way that I believe we can have immigration and legality too, I believe we can have immigration and assimilation too. And, I sometimes say to audiences, if I thought that in my nephews and nieces' lives, Spanish would be more the language than English, or, our politics would look more like Mexican politics, or, I thought that we were going to, that Latino fatalism was going to take over from American belief in agency and free will, I too would say these economic costs and benefits costs are not worth it. If we were at risk of changing the culture in those ways, then we would really have to fight the laws of supply and demand and do something about it. But I don't believe that that's what we're seeing. I believe we're seeing mostly the picture, and there's a lot of data to support it, and I'm sure Matt will talk more about this aspect of things. I believe that mostly what we're seeing in the data is a generation or a cohort that's adapting to American ways as quickly, if not more quickly, than immigrants of 100 years ago did. People are, the second generation, virtually all become proficient or better in English, all prefer English. People do move up the socioeconomic ladder. There's a lot of evidence, and I'm not, giving you all the numbers. I think there are causes for concern, and I would like to see us as a country be having a much more active, taking a much more active role in helping people become Americans, saying we welcome you, we want you to become Americans, we think it's important, here are the steps we'd like to see you take, and then, in fact, once we set those goals, providing people with the tools. As is, there are 10 people waiting for every seat in an English class in New York City, and that's true around the country. We should be asking people to learn English. And I don't think the government, I think it should be a private-public collaboration, should be teaching people English, helping them people become citizens, talking about what it really means to become a citizen, and talking about what it really means to be an American. But I think, though there are, to sort of sum up what's now become 11 minutes, There are shadowy spots. You know, Mexican-American education, culture of education is a problem. Security is going to be a problem till we fix the law. We do have to work out the balance between taxes paid in at the federal level and services used at the local level. But I really strongly believe that immigration, that if you look across the board at the effects, immigration is, as it has always been, what makes this country great. And we don't have to make choices between immigration and legality or immigration and assimilation or immigration and security. If we manage it better, we really can have all of those things. But I think we do have to change the law in order to manage it better.
Thanks, Tamara. Ben?
Thanks. Thanks, Gene. And thank you, Tamara. I think what I'm going to do is try to stick to my 5 minutes. Tamara has a lot more information to tell us. Good information. And what I want to do is raise some reservations I might have about some things. To some extent, because I do have those reservations, but also to be a little bit more of a provocateur in a conversation. What I want to do is spend some time raising reservations and then talking about some things that I think we're not focusing on that I think are the real things that get at some of the questions you've raised here. Because in general, I strongly agree, and Tamara and I have worked together quite a bit on this issue, that we can design a very positive, strong, pro-immigration policy. But I think how we do it is extremely important. And I think we cannot assume that the assimilation patterns historically will merely repeat themselves. And I think if we don't seriously take some of those things into consideration, they aren't going to repeat themselves. And as of right now, some of the patterns, I think, suggest that they are not repeating themselves now. And to expand that problem, which I think the magnitude of the immigration reforms potentially would do, is something that we ought to be concerned about, in my opinion. As to reservations, I'll mention some things briefly just because I want to put them out on the table. Because I thought of this in terms of the current proposals, and then as a secondary matter came to the various things that are raised in terms of the four or five issues that Gene mentioned to us. It's my general opinion that none of the proposals currently out there floating right now are very serious on security matters. They fiddle with things around the edges. Generally speaking, I don't think they're very serious. Putting more money into guards and fences will be apt to spend more money rather than actually solve problems. They might not actually have the desired effect. They're not very creative. I also don't think that the general approach concerning the amnesty question is something I don't like, both in principle and practice. The earned citizenship that is presented now isn't that different, really, from the 86 bill, and that raises very serious prudential questions about whether that is repeating itself. In terms of temporary workers, the problem with the current proposals, and here I mean the Senate proposal, but also Mike Pence's Republican proposal, is they aren't really temporary workers. They are essentially delayed permanent residents. Those plans, as they're written out, tend not to be very free market. They're not very flexible. They're not very economically flexible. They tend to be regulated. They tend to involve the Department of Labor a little bit too much. Those are practical things. Why do I focus on those things? It seems to me that the types of things we are debating are narrow particulars having to do with immediate political circumstances, pieces of the puzzle we're trying to make fit together. But we're not really getting at, I think, the larger questions. The Senate proposal that was presented, which will likely be the basis of something that might come up again, is a large piece of legislation. The numbers involved are large. We're already at historic highs. This would expand it considerably. Our work on those numbers originally was higher, but now, given amendments in the Senate, comes out to about $60 million over 20 years. That was criticized by the White House, but the CRS report upon which it was based actually waters out to about the same as our numbers, given that theirs was a 10-year prediction. Large numbers coming from the same regions, which is currently the case, speaking one language, largely of of low skill and low education levels. I don't raise that because I don't like the individuals involved or where they're coming from, but just as a practical matter. Those ingredients do not encourage and contribute to strong assimilation policies. It makes it more difficult to assimilate. Living in enclaves makes it harder for those populations to become involved in American society. Participation rates are low. Success in the economic marketplace is diminished as a result. That's something that I find to be very concerning. In terms of economics, at Heritage, we're having our own debate internally on the economics of immigration. In terms of fiscal costs, however, the picture, I think, actually looks more bleak or is more troubling. I think in the end, economics actually outweighs it, but I think the fiscal argument is significant. Immigration, it becomes fiscally a positive only farther down the road, namely several generations in. Indeed, it's a long-term fiscal benefit. In the short term, it's actually fiscal costs. And that's largely tied to skill levels, education levels, and things like that. That's a concern because the numbers we're talking about bringing into this country, with the assimilation problems I alluded to earlier, are likely, potentially, I guess something we should be concerned about, to assimilate into a welfare state mentality. Illegitimacy rates are only slightly lower than immigrants, than native Hispanics here in the case of Mexican immigrants. Crime is not an issue. Tamar's absolutely right about that. The crime rates here are much higher than immigrants coming in. One would be concerned, however, if they pick up those patterns. Language acquisition is slow, even in second generation. It's nowhere near the rates of other immigrant groups. These things make it very hard to accommodate the size and magnitude of the immigration changes we're talking about. In the end, I guess I agree with Milton Friedman. You can't have a open immigration system and the welfare state. Ultimately, I think these things collide with each other. We might choose to do so because of long-term economic reasons, but the way we're talking about immigration now seems to me to be potentially and probably amounts to an expansion of the welfare state, essentially importing poverty. That might be something we're willing to take on for other reasons, but I think we should talk about that up front and consider that. Those are my reservations. What are the kind of parameters I think we should be thinking about? What I would like to see, and I'll just here mention four things, and a fifth thing as a conclusion to that. One is I think we should be talking about the issue of family reunification. We actually do want to have more immigration, I think, in the end. What we want to do is have good immigration, immigration that is conducive to assimilation and participation in the American system, the American economy. Family reunification currently eats up 80% of legal immigration in the United States. It should be more narrowly defined, it seems to me, to immediate family members rather than cousins and things like that. We should have more high-skilled immigration, more competitive immigration, and limit low-skilled immigration. The second thing, I've actually come to the conclusion over this discussion, this debate, to the point, at least myself, not necessarily at Heritage Foundation, that I'm very reluctant and probably opposed to a guest worker program. If it's too big of a guest worker program, it overwhelms the system. If it becomes merely an avenue for circumventing the legal immigration and naturalization system, that doesn't seem to serve its purpose. On the other hand, if it's too small, what's the point of that? It doesn't serve any purpose at all. If we need more population and workers, what I'd prefer to do is to have more legal immigration. Do it the old-fashioned way. Those that immigrate here, it seems to me, should be on the citizenship track, and let's skip the facade of a guest worker program. if that's what we want. Third thing, I think we do need to be serious about assimilation. Here, I think Tamar and I agree. It doesn't occur on its own. It's currently not seen as a central concern. We also have to grapple with the fact that many of the immigration advocacy groups are dead set against it in principle. Now, I'm not as worried about others, indeed some of our friends who lament this, but I think there are certain key things we do have to focus on, civic principles, common principles about American institutions and how they operate, but also language. I mean, language, study after study, shows that language is the key to participating in economic success. We should insist upon that. The Alexander Amendment and the Inhofe Amendment in the Senate, I think, are really starting points on that. And the last thing I'll throw out there is what I like to call the expansion of citizenship, an issue that's been debated, I know, from the, in front of the Federal Society, which has to do with the birthright citizenship issue, which is to say that I think Congress should make the law consistent with the Wong Kim Ark case. They should have birthright citizenship include children born of permanent residence, which is what that decision actually said. They should retroactively grant citizenship to those who are already born here, so we're not taking anybody's citizenship away. And then they should grant an automatic appeal and expedited review to applicants once they reach the age of 18. It's currently the law that someone who's born here can appeal for their parents' residency. In the meantime, let's grant them, meaning those families, temporary residence. Why is this a good policy idea? Half of the illegal immigration population in the United States currently, about half of it, includes a born U.S. citizen whose parents are illegal, whose siblings are illegal. If you count those parents and their siblings, that comes out to about half of the illegal population. This gives a principled way to divide that population and take those that have children that are embedded in our society, that are here to stay, and put them on the citizenship route and assimilate them into our society. It's family-friendly, and it also resolves, I think, a legal loophole. It also creates a one-time deal, since we're going to get rid of it. The others, we can incentivize some ways to go out and participate in the legal program. And after that, let's expand legal immigration. The key to all the questions, I think, that Gene has rightly raised, demographics, crime, costs, all of those are tied to our ability to make sure immigrants assimilate and assimilate well. It seems to me that every policy, save for security, the main security issues, everything else should be subservient to the principle, what is the best thing for an immigrant to assimilate into America? Because if they can, the demographic issue, the crime issue, the cost issue, all fall by the wayside, in my opinion. And that's the main issue.
So do I get an answer? Can I answer a little bit? Can we go back and forth, or do you want to go right to the...
I'm sort of inclined to bring the audience okay. in and then have you answer okay. in the process of that, because okay. If that's okay. If anybody has questions right now, go ahead. If you have any lag in questions, we'll...
Somebody ask Tamar what she thinks.
It seems to me that assimilation is a key, and both of you are talking about this. And our focus then is always on the immigrant community and on its effective, either its ability to assimilate or its failure to assimilate. But it seems to me that we oftentimes ignore the host culture. In other words, the host country here, our culture, and our expectation of assimilation. How can we really achieve assimilation when we're operating under a decline of the assimilation model, when we're operating under a notion of cultural relativism or operating under the multicultural model, which really hobbles us from expecting assimilation?
Do we let some questions accumulate, or do you want to...
Go ahead.
I give a short immediate answer to that one, which is that one of the reasons why I think this is immigration is a great thing for us to have a national debate upon is precisely the debate about immigration forces us to debate what we ourselves believe and contributes to a broader civic understanding. So I think it's a help to that.
And I actually think... I think what we're going to see in the next year or so... I think assimilation is going to kind of be one of the next big things. I think it's when you look at the iceberg, as it were, of the public's concern about immigration. The stuff that we hear about, you know, economic security, all that stuff is the tip of the iceberg, and assimilation is the big part of the iceberg under the water. And I think that's going to become increasingly clear, and both politicians and the debate and everybody else is going to have to respond to it. And I think we are going to respond. I think what we're going to find is that there's much more will to talk about what do we think it means to be an American, that the multiculti is kind of is also a small part of the population, and the, you know, American public are very committed to the notion that people will come here and put down roots and invest and become Americans. And it's really a question of I think kind of partly political leadership, but I'd also like to see corporate America in the game of ramping up and saying we're going to do something about this. And I think, you know, with the right, I think you will see that. I mean, every foundation in America now is thinking, how can I put more money into, and they don't always get it right. They don't understand that it has to have enough patriotism. So they call it integration, and sometimes they mean learning to function here rather than really buying into the American ethos. But I think you're going to see in the next year or two an explosion of debate about this and much more actual will than we think we have to assert what we think it means to be an American and to actually help people do it. So,
isn't it conceivable though that many people opposed to immigration are opposed to it because of this anxiety as to whether they legitimately can expect assimilation? This anxiety over whether, as you pointed out, can we expect a country of one language?
Yeah, I think it is about that anxiety, but I think there's not an immigrant parent in America that doesn't want their kids to learn English. They know English is the language of success. The kids know English is the language of success and of, you know, what kids care about, of, you know, hip and...
And if you look at, even you look at the conservative, the real conservative, real hard conservative critics of immigration, they almost all still argue very strongly for assimilation. As immigration under the right circumstances,
right.
they just are right. even more reluctant about its possibility. And if you look at the immigrants themselves, right there's something just recently about that. Overwhelmingly, they want to learn English. That is, they're not opposed to assimilation. It's really this elite debate in many ways, and
right.
kind of within the in within Washington and in the universities, whereas it's more intellectual debate about these principles. But in
I think that's
the ground upon which there's broad agreement. And it's also the ground upon which historically immigration policy has worked in America.
And I mean, you know, what you had 100 years ago in the Americanization movement was you had businesses and government stepping up to the plate and people volunteering to help and immigrants taking the classes. And I think once you started something going like that, you would see that the multicultures really were on the margins. And people, the public would see immigrants wanting to take advantage of those classes, the English classes, and wanting to naturalize in greater numbers. And it could have a kind of a positive feedback effect.
John, you had your hand up.
Yes, I'd like to focus a bit on the assimilation issue. Well, first, two issues. One, I'll get to the assimilation in a moment. Well, first of all, what about the political issue here? What it seems to be going on, of course, is that, as I understand it, Democrats are very enthusiastic because they think that the faster route to citizenship, the more immigration, the more they're likely to be able to take political control. Isn't that one of the really underlying issues beyond the immigration debate? And then when we go to the question of assimilation, why can't one use citizenship as a vehicle for assimilation, making it a requirement that actually people learn English quite well? There'd be a language test, a very substantial language test for citizenship. We already seem, as I understand it, we're moving to a harder, even civic understanding test for citizenship as a part of that participation. So isn't that a way of trying to force assimilation? And I think that is very important because I think it ties back into this political debate because people who are more assimilated, I think, are less likely to be clients of the welfare state, which is, I think, one of the reasons, and a rather cynical and hard-bitten view I have, that Democrats are so enthusiastic about
immigration. I find it hard to believe you're cynical, John.
I mean, I think, well, a couple of things. I mean, I want to dissent from the notion that we want to force people to assimilate. I think we want to seduce people to assimilate. Coercion doesn't really work. You want people to love America and want to participate here. So I don't think we want to force anyone. I think we want to create incentives and I think people, you never meet a Mexican immigrant. You ask people who've been here a couple of weeks, how do you like America? And the first thing they say is what's great about it is you don't have to bribe the cops. And then, you explain to them, well, that's the rule of law. I mean, they very quickly, they come for economic opportunity, and it doesn't take long for people to see what's great here that they don't have at home. And that's how you want to assimilate people, is by winning their hearts and minds, not forcing anyone. But I do think that the way is through language and naturalization. I think there's no question about that. That's exactly how you want to do it. And that's about, it is about tests, but it's also about making the tools of, making it possible. Right now, people wait 6 years to naturalize. People wait for English classes. People learn English on the street and from TV, but it's hard to learn it any other way. So we want to both set higher goals and say that we want people to assimilate and make the citizenship process more meaningful, but it's not about forcing people. About Democrats wanting voters, President Bush showed what can be done with the Latino population, 40% of the vote. Latinos are not necessarily Democratic voters. They have conservative social values. They actually believe in, strong military. They are not blacks long ago decided that, you couldn't be black and Republican. Latinos have made no such choice. Unfortunately, the immigration debate is I believe the ugly tone of some of the immigration debate of the last year is driving a lot of Latinos away from the party. But I don't think it has to be a foregone conclusion that Latinos are not going to be Republican voters. But we have to make a lot better effort to win them than I think we've been making in the last year or so.
Just a partially technical answer. There is an English test along with the civics test, and it is also being beefed up, if you will. And it'll be a new version of that will be piloted as well, which will require written and verbal English. There is a requirement that one has to be English literate to get U.S. citizenship. It's not enforced very well. I think it should be more enforced. I agree with Tamar. We want to seduce people, but having said that, as good professors, we all know that it also requires a test once in a while. I think those things do have to be held to pretty strongly, and the problem is that those particulars are hard fought on every time they come up. I think it'll be a real test to see what happens if an immigration debate really occurs this spring as to whether those elements which were hard fought to get in the previous version actually stay in there. I think those things are crucially important. The other thing I think that's important, and once we start going down the assimilationist route, we have to grapple with is are these various questions about allegiances, right? The other requirement of citizenship is you declare your allegiance to the United States and you renounce your other allegiances. But, of course, that comes up to this whole questions of dual citizenship, which in many cases is not a problem at all, really. But at some level, raises serious questions, I think. My general answer is I think it's great to have those debates, and we should have them more rather than less. But my guess is that the immigrant advocate groups want to shunt that aside as much as they can, and even though they are a minority opinion in the larger sense of things, they're very powerful and vocal. And they would like not to have that debate, I think.
Yeah, I think, I mean, now we're going to get lost in our own conversation again, but I think the immigrant advocate groups are not necessarily as much as a problem as you think, in the sense that people who really are the immigrant advocate groups, I'm not talking about Latino activists or multicultural activists on campus, but we participated in a process where we spent a lot of time talking to a left and right conversation about assimilation a couple years ago with immigrant advocates. And the deal, really, the right-left deal there, is the immigrant advocates want more services for the immigrants. But that, in large part, means English language services. And the right wants more talk about patriotic meaning. And, you know, that can be a pretty explicit deal that, you know, they're willing to, if there's more money, either from the corporate sector or from the government for services, they're happy to inject more patriotic meaning. And I think we're not opposed to the services, right, as long as the services are English language. That I think there might be more of a strange bedfellow coalition to be formed between you, as it were, and some of the immigrant advocates on the
interesting practical test will be this Alexander Amendment, which was actually put into the legislation I referred to, had a provision in there that it beefed up both civics and English language. But what it did is also took immigrant fees and essentially created a voucher, which Weed Heritage liked, to give those immigrants to go out and take civics and English courses. And indeed, if you learn English, you could take 1 year off of your residence. That is, you could get American citizenship a year earlier if you learned English. And
nobody's against that.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I'm all in favor of that.
I too am pro-immigration, but on the assumption of assimilation and non-welfare state benefits. But the assimilation issue is something I've been thinking about, and it's the biggest concern of mine, because the multiculturalist ideology isn't a dominant ideology now in our educational system, because, you know, there were just a small number of people who were advocating it. I mean, it was an ideology that was advanced and propagated, and you never need a large number of people to have an idea take over very successfully. And I believe that multiculturalism as an ideology, cultural relativism, has taken over and dominates the elites of this country. And it's actually the minority who aren't multiculturalists among the elites, to the point that the type of seduction of assimilation that you talk about is now referred to as cultural tyranny. I mean, I still remember about a year ago, I saw a description of how Henry Ford was one of the private parties that engaged in assimilation, right, of immigrants at the turn of the last century. And he would actually have a ceremony where the immigrants who worked for him would actually, he required them to buy houses and open checking accounts, but he also did a ceremony when they became citizens where they climbed up into a ladder and jumped into this big human pot,
right,
and changed out of their traditional garb from their home countries and into business suits or dresses that Americans wore and climbed out. And this was described in terms of, look at this tyranny, look at how horrible Henry Ford was for doing this to these poor workers who had to work for him and had no choice to do this because he controlled them with his, you know, iron capitalist fist. So this is what's being taught in our, yeah, universities, and so I'm very concerned in seeing the activist groups, the immigration groups, the protest, you know, the protests from a couple months ago with the Mexican, the people saying, you know, Mexican culture now, Mexican culture forever, something of that sort, you know, and the Mexican flags, and they weren't immigrants that we normally think of historically, right? They were people who were saying, you know, we want to come and enjoy your economic benefits, but we want to recreate our country here.
Yeah, no, well, a couple of things. David Brooks has a trope where he says, you know, your sense of the state of America can be very different if you live primarily on a college campus or you live off a college campus. I mean, one can have a really different idea of the sort of economic or the cultural health of the country from those two points of view. And, you know, I really would argue that, first of all, that the sure, you know, we do live in a different country than the 1950s. I mean, the kind of rhetoric of difference is valuable, you know, there's no question. That has become, you know, the credo. But I think most Americans, if you ask them, is what we have important and what we have in common more important than our differences, I think, you know, 95% of Americans would agree on that. And that there is something that we have in common that's important, there's a there that people, you know, people kind of, they might not even be able to talk to you about it, but they know there's a there. And I think if we started a conversation that was around immigrant assimilation, that where we started to ask people, what is that there? And what does the flag mean to you? And what does being an American mean to you? That could be a wonderful conversation for the country to have. And I think we'd find the answers much more, I think you'd find the range of answers much more healthy than you're hearing on your college campus. And I think immigrants, I mean, your characterization of the rallies, let me talk for a minute about the rallies and about Mexican political participation. Mexico, you know, would like Mexicans to be voting in Mexico. So they passed a law a couple of years ago where they made that possible, and they made a big campaign to ask people to vote. Well, there are 10 million Mexicans who fall under eligible under that law who could conceivably have voted in Mexico for the last Mexican presidential election. Well, guess how many of that 10 million did? Less than 40,000. How many people came out into the streets in those rallies? Over a million. And they were participating in American politics, and they knew they were participating in American politics. And yes, some of them were waving flags, but they weren't waving flags saying we want to go back and be in Mexico. It was more a statement of we're here as Mexicans trying to have a voice. But what they were chanting was we want to be legal here. We want to have the right to stay here and work. They weren't saying we want to be Mexicans. You can look at those flags a lot of different ways, and a lot of emphasis was put on those flags. What those people were doing was participating in American politics and saying we want to be legal, dignified players in this country. They were not voting in the Mexican elections. They were participating in our politics. So, you know, I think there's a failure of leadership in capitalizing on that and saying this means, you know, we want you to become Americans. We want you to become citizens. You know, sign up, line up, whatever. We're not asking for that now, and we should. But I don't think that that there's a lack of desire for a country that has it there and talks about it on either the mainstream side or the immigrant side.
I want to address this real quick as well. I think that the while I grant that if you kind of poll most Americans, there's an innate sense of this understanding of assimilation, which I think that's why I actually see the immigration debate as healthy for the larger cultural debate. But having said that, I think you're actually are correct, which is that I think there's a larger problem out there, and it's not just the universities. The universities might have a much healthier liberal multiculturalist advocacy going on, but what the problem is there's a wide swath of American opinion that might have this innate sense, but they've been taught by their elites for some time, and those elites now have kind of given up on this, right? That this is all quite, this really isn't that meaningful. What we have in common is ultimately our diversity, right? I mean, you know, they kind of have the Supreme Court's view of things, right? You can go define your own view of the universe. Right, I mean, there is a lot of that going on. So I think it's not quite as rosy as we might think. I think there is something to appeal to, which is why I think this is an interesting debate. However, but I think you're right.
Tamar mentioned, if I understood correctly, that we could bring the quota up from 1 million a year to 1.5 million. And I guess I'm thinking I can imagine sort of two different ways of doing that. One model would be basically to sort of take the allocation from the whole world, you know, sort of country by country. And another model, maybe it's done through guest workers and other mechanisms, would basically take from sort of neighboring country, Mexico and Central America. And I guess I'm wondering, you might think that the former model, taking from all throughout the world, would have less sort of negative effects from an assimilation perspective, from the language perspective. I'm just wondering if that's true, if you think that's the case, or you think it really wouldn't make much difference, would we still then get a large number of illegal immigrants coming from Mexico if we did it from the world allocation system? So
yeah.
I was wondering if you both could talk to that issue.
That's a good question.
In my initial 5 minutes, you know, I was talking about, is immigration good for America? I wasn't actually defending any of the bills on the table, which I, you know, now can do. I mean, Matt took me on kind of on the reform. I wasn't making the case for the reform before.
I was expecting you to make that clear.
But I hadn't. My sense of what the most important principle behind the reform is, we want to take the reality that's out there now and we want to manage it better. We don't want to try to change that reality. We don't want I see it as a kind of a river, or, you know, the sun rising, that these economic and demographic shifts have shifted things and that we have this flow that's about a market flow. I don't think we want to create a situation where we start new streams of people from countries that have never come before that grow into large rivers. We want to take the river that's already happening and channel it better and make sure that it's not flooding the plain, which is effectively what it's doing now. So I don't you know, I think it would be very hard to stop the Mexican flow and the Central American flow. And once you started a Chinese flow, you know, you'd be sorry down the road if you started a big Chinese flow. So I think very much you want the model of let's take the reality that we have now, and instead of having these people come illegally, let's try to have them figure out a way for them to come legally, rather than opening new streams and new languages and what's called chain migration. Because people don't wake up in the morning, you know, in the middle of China and say, gee, I think I'll go to America now. You know, what city should I go to? People go when they have a relative there already, or when they have a cousin there, or when they have a friend there from their village. And you don't want to create a lot of new threads for new chains to form around. You want to take the chains we have now and make them basically legal. And it is going to be, when Mexico does a bit, Mexican birth rates are falling. Mexico is slowly and imperfectly and two steps back for every step forward developing. You know, when Mexico becomes a developed country and people stop wanting to come to America, we're going to have a problem because where are we then going to find the labor? I mean, people sometimes say Mexican development would be the answer. If Mexico became Switzerland tomorrow, we'd have to look somewhere else, or we would not be able to sustain the economic growth that we've seen in the past 10 years. And sure, you know, maybe then eventually there will be more Chinese, but it's not something that we want to create now. So strongly on the model of take what we have now and make it legitimate.
Matt, how does that work in with your brain drain?
Contrary
on the surface, just to cause trouble.
Well,
if you were saying, you know, one of the things that would be good would be if,
I think we want to have a free market. I mean,
if we had more immigrants who were somewhat higher on the educational level and somewhat more the perhaps type of immigrant we've historically had, I sensed you to say, it would be better. And it seems to me as though, as I say, at least for purposes of troublemaking, that runs directly against what Tamara was just saying.
We haven't historically had more skilled, though. Immigrants have always been.
No, but historically, there's been a mix, and I think what I'd prefer is a market system where mm-hmm. it's open. There's more competition. You're getting more immigration from a mix of places, a mix of language, a mix of backgrounds. That is more conducive to assimilation as a model. Whether it's from Mexico or anywhere else, if they're all, you know.
We have a market system. That's exactly what we have now.
No, we don't, because very restricted market. It's overwhelmingly coming from Mexico and Latin America. With family reunification, that makes it even stronger. That's a very dominant effect on the immigration system. That's not good for assimilation. I would much prefer to have some sort of market system that allows for us to take into consideration the immense pressure coming from Mexico right now, because I was going to note what you were going to note. Demographically, Mexican population is going to decline. So why would we now set as a matter of law and permanency a relationship with an inflow coming only from Mexico and Latin America? Let's accommodate that as best we can some way through a legal system, but let's open up our immigration system to allow for a free market of immigrants to come here from wherever they want to come here. One of the things that's beautiful about American immigration is that someone from China can come here, from anywhere in the world can come here. I think we shouldn't kind of isolate ourselves in the sense that somehow they're coming here anyway, so let's open up and make it all legal. I've never quite bought that argument.
I think what we have is a free market, and a free market that is in pretty much equilibrium, which is why having a guest worker program would not change the numbers particularly. I think we have supply and demand that's pretty much in equilibrium, and what we want to do is recognize that market and stop trying to regulate it to be something that it isn't going to be.
But I think we want to have a free market that allows whoever wants to come in, but the thing that we want to regulate is that we want them to assimilate.
I agree.
And the concern I have is that the model we're currently at, if it expands the way it's planned to expand, which is dominantly from one region, low-skilled, low-education, essentially importing high school dropouts, if you want to put it in the harshest terms, is not conducive for the kind of assimilation necessary for the success of immigrants, for their success.
Okay, well,
let me
just throw out a couple of numbers. It's if you look at the immigrant population, about a third are high school dropouts. About a third have college degrees, and there's a third in between.
But look at immigrants coming from Mexico and Latin America.
Yeah,
it's a much different picture.
Yes, and about half come from Mexico and Latin America, and a quarter come from Asia. It's not the picture that you're describing.
It's incorrect. It's three quarters come from Mexico and Latin America.
No, that's not true.
I can show you. Yeah. I've got the numbers.
Yeah. Illegal.
Illegal 80%. Is 80%.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you combine Mexico and all the Latin American countries, it's about America, 3/4.
Yeah. I don't think. Well, you know, I don't think it's as monolithic as you're arguing.
It's something to be very concerned about. Yeah. When you're importing a population that has 3/4 do not have a complete high school diploma, that's something we're going to have to deal with one way or the other. We might still choose to do that for demographic reasons, but that's an immense cost we need to calculate into this discussion.
Yeah, I think your numbers are off there too.
I
think your numbers are off there too. I mean, we'll have to get out our charts.
No, we'll have to. But I mean, that's
isn't one of the questions not just a question of whether somebody has a high school degree, but I mean, one of the things about the immigrants that we classically think of in this country is they were people who, whatever their background was, they were people who had the entrepreneurship and the energy and the determination to immigrate in a day and a time when it was very, very hard. Now, there's still a little bit of that, I think, but it's probably not as hard as it was. And I don't know whether that greatly affects the immigrant pool, but I suspect it does. And is that taken into account of in what you're...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how one would compare what people had to do 100 years ago with what people do now, but, you know, several hundred people die every year crossing the desert. I mean, it's not easy. I think we are still getting. I mean,
you're getting the most entrepreneurial.
And the ones who stay are the most entrepreneurial again. I spent some time in one of the sending villages that sends people to New York a couple of years ago. And so I met everybody, 100 people in New York from that village, and then I went back and spent a month in the village. And what you see is that all the young men, at 18, all the young men in the town go to New York. And, you know, they go to New York because that's where their cousins are. So they all go to New York. And many of them spend about 18 months there. And then they miss mama and they miss their girlfriends and they miss the cooking and the work's too hard. And the bottom of the pyramid, I don't know what percentage it is, goes home after 18 months. And then after 5 years, another chunk go home. They've made their money. They've sent money home. They did their rite of passage, but they didn't fall in love with America. They want to go back. They want to have their kids and get married and go back. A big chunk go home at 5 years. In the town, all the people running the stores are people who were in New York for 5 years. At 10 years, another chunk decide to go home. They have their kids and they're deciding where their kids are going to grow up and they go home at that point. The people who've been in New York for 25 years or own the coffee shops where they started as busboys, own the lawn mowing services where they started as the guy behind the lawn mowers. The ones who fall in love and are most successful are the ones that stay, and that's exactly as we should want it. And that's the argument And that's the argument in my view. Because the reality is many people do in the beginning want to just come and make some money and work for a few years and then go back. And we ought to have a system where we allow that and we don't give permanent residence to people who necessarily don't want to stay. Because I don't think you want to cheapen the currency of green cards. I don't think you want to give a lot of green cards to people who only want to work for a while. So I think we want a system where people do come either temporarily or provisionally, and then the ones who are the best and the brightest and want to stay and do get what America's about in the deepest way are people we encourage to put down roots and assimilate and stay.
Right. Well, I agree that's the group we want. I just don't – I'm very reluctant and worried about creating a permanent serf class.
Kind
of a feudal system where we have low-class, low-skilled immigrants that aren't allowed to participate in the American economy and rise up, and yet it's a population group that we have to deal with, this country, because people aren't widgets.
I completely agree.
And I just doubt they'll get it right.
Yeah, well, we're trying.
It seems to me that one of, if not the most significant sticking point in the debate has been the fate of the 12 million. And I'm wondering what the thoughts of the two of you are following a year or two here of enriching public debate about questions about the rule of law and what to do with the 12 million, because it seemed to me in the floor debate last year that really was the sticking point between the House Republicans and really the to some extent the Senate Republicans, but especially the other side.
First I'd like to put it in a little bit of context because, you know, I think what we want in the future is a system where instead of what we have now, which are nudge, nudge, wink, wink, unrealistic immigration quotas that we don't enforce seriously. That's the current situation. We want to get to a new world where we have realistic laws in line with market demand that we do enforce to the letter and we mean it. And that's the most important part of the change. And the 12 million are really just a transition to get there. It's you can't create a new serious system on the basis of rampant law breaking. So it's a one-time transition, and yet you're right, it became the biggest obstacle in the debate. You know, my argument is it's not for them, it's for our sake as a country. We don't want a situation where we have a population the size of the state of Pennsylvania living on the wrong side of the law. I think that's bad for security. These people, we don't know their real names, they've never been through a background check. It's bad for assimilation. How can they assimilate? They're not even legitimate here. It's bad for it's bad for the erosion of the rule of law. It's bad all along the on every dimension you can think of. Even for employers, I would argue in the long run, it's an unacceptable, untenable situation. So the question is, what do you do about them? And nobody thinks that. I don't think anybody thinks. That we should just wave a wand and say what you did didn't matter, or at least sure, there's some advocates that think that, but I don't think that, and I don't think the American public thinks that. We do want to say you did do something wrong, and there's some cost to it. But the question is, what do we do? I don't think we're going to round up 12 million people and deport them. I don't think if we significantly make their lives more miserable, cut back on, they get virtually no benefits. I mean, this idea that they're living in the welfare state, I mean, what they get is K-12 education and emergency room health care. We could take those things away. I don't think attrition is going to work. I don't think we're going to drive them out by making their lives a little more difficult. They're already people who've, risked death in the desert to get here. So I think for our sake, we've got to figure out some way for them to get onto the right side of the law. And shrink the number perhaps some smaller percentage we could convince to go home or make a home or whatever if it was small and they were the outliers. So I think you want a situation where you set up some system of hoops that we ask them to jump through to get onto the right side of the law. We can argue and debate and negotiate over what exactly those hoops should be. I think the idea of making them work, pay taxes, pay a significant fine, wait their turn in line to get to be, full-fledged legal residents, start to learn English and prove that they do want to be Americans. I think that's a pretty reasonable set of things. Do we want to also make them come home and come back? Well, we could consider that. Do we want to add some hoops? We can consider that. But once you get the basic idea that they're here and it's in our interest to have them legal, then we're just talking about the price of what they have to do, and we can have a negotiation about that price. That's reasonable to me.
I think tomorrow. I agree with tomorrow. Almost everything she just said. It's just I would call it for what it is. It is an amnesty. 86 legislation. This legislation differ a few places here and there, but they're essentially the same. They're negotiating about what exactly are the costs we're going to put on it. It's an amnesty.
But 86 is different.
In principle, it is not different. If you lay the legislation side by side and look at them, they're not in principle different. They're both amnesties. I'd be willing to accept that and argue in favor of it, as a matter of fact, as a prudential decision. The key thing is not the amnesty itself. The key thing is what are you going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again? Because the problem with 86 was it didn't solve a problem. Illegal immigration slowed down for a few months, started up again. It wasn't followed up with political willpower afterwards. The enforcement mechanisms in the bill weren't followed through. And so people are reluctant today to make the same deal again when they don't think that Ted Kennedy and his guys are going to back it up. They're not going to fulfill the other side of the deal. And this isn't going to solve anything. So there's a reluctance, there's a belief that there's something unfair about it. But I think if you have enough requirements, okay, we can deal on that. I would agree with that as a prudential matter. The problem, however, is that, why is this not going to happen 20 years from now? And I don't think as a country we can establish a kind of a jubilee policy. Every 20 years we just forgive everything. as a matter of principle, and I just think it's a bad policy.
No, and I don't think we should have a Jubilee policy, but the problem with 86, the amnesty worked great in 86, and it was an amnesty and it worked great. What we didn't do was create a temporary worker program. So we didn't bring the quotas into line with the supply and demand. So, you know, again, you can think, if you think of it as a flow of water, the pipeline's not big enough, the water's coming through the ceiling and creating a puddle on the floor, you know, we just allowed another puddle to accumulate. So now we have to deal with that puddle. If we had a temporary worker program or expanded green cards or whatever you want to do to allow the intake to be more in line with supply and demand, we wouldn't have another pool of 12 million people.
Okay, so here's the easy compromise. Here's the easy compromise then. Let's institute the security measures, the internal enforcement measures, and let's start a pilot temporary worker program to try to get those mechanisms back into balance. Then let's figure out how to deal with those that are currently here. Because you can prudentially give an amnesty to those that are here after you have already in place the security mechanisms which some of us don't think the Democratic Party is going to follow through with once they get their amnesty.
Yeah, and the only problem with that is, you know, politicians aren't going to come back to the table to do amnesty alone. The problem is,
so,
you know,
so what's
going to
happen?
Package.
So then you're going to get 86 again, which is that you get the...
Not if you have a temporary worker program.
Yeah, but you're going to get a temporary worker program that, unless you convince Ted Kennedy otherwise, you're going to get a temporary worker program that's not truly a temporary worker program, that's large numbers, and you're going to get an amnesty. And all the security stuff's going to fall by the wayside. I don't think so.
Now we can talk about politics, which we haven't talked about. No bill, you know, despite the Democrats being in control of Congress, no immigration reform bill is going to pass Congress without a significant number of Republicans. Democrats are ambivalent about it as Republicans are. They don't have enough people to pass a bill alone, despite their majorities. This is going to take at least 20 Republicans in the Senate, and, you know, McCain would like 30, and at least 40 or 50 Republicans in the House. So, you know, contrary to what the New York Times would tell you, we are not going to have, you know, a lefty Ted Kennedy giveaway immigration bill that passes now. Anything that passes is going to be a bipartisan bill, up the center, compromise. You know, McCain is not going to sign on to a bill that is at all to the left of what passed last year. He just can't. You know, he's running for president. So to pass something, you know, it's going to have to have. I mean, you didn't like the bill last year, obviously, but you know the idea that the bill.
The idea that
we're not going to have enforcement, or that we're not going to have security in the bill, or that we're not going to have assimilation in the bill.
It gets back to the timing issue. I mean, I think if you could have taken the Senate bill as proposed last time as a prudential matter, I think that would have been acceptable if there had been a serious process laid out as to how it was going to be phased in, so that both sides get what they want over time. And that there are ways that if something doesn't happen, the thing stops. But that was never seriously discussed because no one wants to do that. They want to get their piece and go home. Both sides are guilty of that.
I guarantee you if a bill passes, it will have a trigger and an enforcement trigger.
A serious trigger.
Time.
I wanted to follow up on John McGinnis's question because, and maybe slightly broaden it, because I think there's actually some agreement on the assimilation and parts of ways to work that. But I would make it much broader than the question of just political party. I think the question, which I suspect bothers an awful lot of Americans who are not instinctively anti-immigrant, and there's some who obviously are, but the majority are not, is how do we get immigrants who, what do we do about the immigrants and how many are there, I guess, who basically, it's not just a question of whether they might vote Democratic or not, that could be one issue, but much more serious, who are not really desirous of being Americans, or not fully desirous of being Americans. They may be desirous of residing here and trying to turn the country into what they might want it to be as quickly as possible. But the view, I think this is an important part to, I have good friends on both sides of this, and I think this is an important part that the people who are on the pro-immigration side, which generally I view myself as being on, don't resist, and I think maybe you're resisting a little bit, so I'll try to push. What do you do? And you might say there aren't really skin in the room. What do you do about the immigrants who really are not who are captured by some of the extremists? Because maybe they didn't come over here that way, but pretty quickly they're getting to, and they're going to vote. They're going to vote Democrat. It's not just they might vote Democratic, but they're going to be captured into sort of activist. What we view is not very friendly to the American dream, which is what I think we all probably want. I think most people would agree with immigrants who want to live the American dream, by and large, we want. Immigrants who don't want to live the American dream, by and large, we don't. well, that's all very well. How do you?
Right. How do you?
So
yeah.
What do you do about that type of?
Well, first of all, I'd argue that very few actual first-generation immigrants get caught up in the sort of multicultural nonsense that you're talking about. The people who get caught up in that are the kids, and the parents, you know, want nothing more than to succeed here. You know, they're working three jobs. You know, they might not have time to learn English, but they're certainly not, you know, wanting to turn America into Mexico or very caught up in. I mean. Find me an immigrant, you know, a Mexican-American worker who's caught up in, find me one, you know, really, you know, find me 10, I guarantee you can't. A first-generation Mexican-immigrant worker who's very caught up in that multicultural dream. The kids get caught up in it when they go to college. And I would argue it's because, you know, so what I would argue in the first generation, people who, sure, most in the first generation, in the beginning, they don't come with stars and stripes in their eyes. They come here to make money. And many of them do go home. And the ones who stay are the ones who get that there's something special about America that they love and buy into. So I don't think the first generation are the problem. The second generation can get caught up in the multi-culti ethos. And I think the special danger would be if they don't advance economically or advance economically with their expectations and they get demoralized for those reasons and multiculti is in the air. You know, sure, you could have a serious problem down the road. I don't disagree with that. But I think the most important thing is that social mobility still does work in America, so they're not languishing as Turks are languishing in Germany outside the economic and educational system. They are moving up. They flirt for a few years in their school and college time with multicultural aspirations, and then most of them, too, want to succeed in America. But we ought to be doing a much better job of marginalizing multiculturalism with a more robust Americanization, assimilation ethos in this country. I mean, there's no question that we ought to be, but I don't see there is a big danger of the second generation moving en masse into sort of multicultural, you know, take back the Southwest or something. I
worry less about the kind of this multicultural philosophy taking over the immigration. Although what I do worry about, which is connected but slightly different, is the immigrant who comes here for good, selfish, economic reasons, which is the root of all good immigration, which I advocate. I mean, right? I'm a Hamiltonian in that sense. You come here out of self-interest, but your self-interest becomes connected and grows from that. I have no problem with that. The problem is that the economic incentives in our country, in the context of a welfare state, are very complicated. And we want to make sure that welfare state does not provide such incentives that they get drawn into that. Labor, as opposed to becoming more actively involved in the economy.
Labor force participation among illegal immigrant men is higher than for any other group in the country. 94% of illegal immigrant men are in the labor force.
Yeah, and immigrants are 2.5 times more likely to use welfare.
No, that's not true. That's not true.
We'll look at our papers again.
Illegal immigrants have no possibility of using welfare.
Immigrants in the United States.
And legal immigrants have no access to welfare for the first five years they're here.
Right, that's right. I'm talking about second, third generation. The question is, do we agree on which I think we agree upon, is that we would like to keep immigrants. We want to have them successfully assimilate, which includes economic assimilation, which means success in the American economic system, and not get sucked into and become dependent on the state.
Of course, we agree on that. Across the board, legal and illegal, compared to others in their socioeconomic bracket, use less welfare. And, you know,
if you break them into demographic groups, they do better than blacks, very much so.
Better than anyone else.
If you look at other immigrant groups like Asians, Hispanics do much worse.
Yeah, Asians are a completely different population. Asians come much more educated. It's a completely different population.
Which is why I get back to the general point that we should be concerned if large amounts of immigration are coming from one area, one region with one language, tending to live in enclaves. That's not a good recipe for good immigration and assimilation.
Asians are not going to work in meatpacking plants. They're not going to work in agriculture. They're not going to work in construction.
Right. So what?
They're not going to work in. We still need we need unskilled workers in this country, and we don't have produce.
So all we can do is get cheap labor from Mexico.
It's not that it's cheap. It's that it's bodies to do that kind of work. Agriculture will leave the United States. Food processing will leave.
But immigrants
are not
bodies and widgets.
No,
they're people.
But we want to come here and become
Americans.
They're growing the economy, and they are becoming Americans.
The ones that are becoming Americans, we want. I have nothing against them.
and bringing an energy and dynamism that I think is beneficial.
But the best thing for assimilation historically has always been a mix of immigrants from different countries, different languages, and different skill and education groups.
It's
overwhelmingly dominated by Mexican, Latin American immigration. It will be even more so with this new legislation, and given family reunification, it's very dominant. That's a recipe for a long-term welfare problem at a time when we're trying to get out of and solve welfare problems, and we should be concerned about that. I agree with Charles Murray on that.
Pat,
this is his concern.
Also, I know early on you wanted to respond.
That's all right. I've had a chance to in the course of... Yeah, yeah.
But just in case, you could feel free to add that to your last answer. Pat.
Well, I'm from academia, so I'm very, you know, self-obsessed and self-involved. And I know you said that the immigrant community, the multi-culti kind of mentality isn't alive, but it's very much alive in the academy.
Sure.
And so I think that's, in a way, what we've been talking about here. I don't have your grasp of policy and of facts, but I do have a grasp of the fact that how can we begin talking about the factors that are conducive to assimilation when we... If I'm talking only about the academy, then that's what I'm talking about. But if we ourselves can't even agree as to whether it's necessary or advisable, and I don't know how we can have the dialogue when Samuel Huntington writes a book called Who Are We? I think that's the title of the book, and he's accused of being a racist. So there's a huge, I think, problem that's internal to us, irrespective of immigration, and the problem is of ourselves and of our expectations to assimilation, which I think in a way is quite different as to whether the immigrant community is actually assimilated. And I get the sense that in fact they are. I get a sense that they are, but they're doing it without much help or expectation from us.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think they are doing it without enough help and enough expectations, and I am very much devoted to trying to change that, but I think it's more changeable than you think. I mean, my answer to a political situation like that is you try to marginalize the people on the extremes of the debate. And I think the people that, you know, if you could get a momentum going and a national... No, but I don't think it's all Democrats. I think, you know, the extreme multi-culti academic universe that you're talking about can be easily marginalized. And, you know, I mean, just an example, one of the kinds of places somebody I'm working with a lot these days on the other across the aisle on this is Henry Cisneros, who, you know, big Democrat, you know, Latino. We're about to launch a group devoted to Americanization that's going to be about trying to get people to more English classes, more naturalization, more patriotic meaning in the naturalization process. And Henry Cisneros is going to take on the multi-culti Latino left and say, you know, it's nonsense. And, you know, it's that kind of movement where somebody like, you know, and then I'll take on Lou Dobbs and say, well, you know, you say you'd be happy with more immigration if they were going to assimilate. You know, are you serious? You know, you marginalize the multi-culti, you know, left, and you marginalize Lou Dobbs with a center that has the public behind you as opposed to just the professors that says, you know, of course, if these people are here, we want them to succeed here, and we want to talk about American values. And it's going to take some time to build, but I believe it's buildable. I believe the you know, you do live in a universe where 90% of the people are sort of talking multi-culti nonsense, but, you know, if you go out in America, most Americans are not really devoted to that. And, you know, you want to build a political movement that's about the general will. Of course, these people, if they're here, they should learn English and they should become Americans. And you marginalize the professors who say, you know, they should, whatever the professors say.
I completely agree with that. That's exactly the strategy. You marginalize it to extremes. The question is whether the lawmaking process can take advantage of that reasonable middle ground. And I have more doubts, I think.
I have some hopes that which I had not heard before, though it's probably quite common, that Tamara might be able to kill this off with the term multiculturalism, off with the term multiculti. Anyway, I thank both of you very much. I had hoped we could have a good discussion I think we have, and I appreciate very much your participation, and thank you all for coming to this conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.